Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. We've just passed the centenary of one of the most important days in British industrial history, the so-called Black Friday, the day in April 1921 when the Transport and Rail Workers Union leaders went back on their promise to support miners who had been locked out of work by the mine owners for refusing to accept pay cuts. The dispute deeply affected many communities in which rugby league was the major sport. During the lockout, Billy Batten, one of three miners in the first 10 members of the Rugby League Hall of Fame, donated £350 of his testimonial fund to mining families in his hometown of Kinsley. Many other acts of solidarity were also organised by the sport. The same also happened in 1926 and 1984, as well as in many other disputes in the coal industry. In fact, I'd probably argue that no sport has such a deep, rich and organic connection with miners and the mining industry than Rugby League. As National Union of Miners President Joe Gormley, a lifelong Wigan supporter, claimed in his autobiography, "There used to be a saying that if you wanted a good prop forward, you only had to shout down the nearest pit shaft and there'd be a good one come up on the next cage." Although people in the North East talked about Newcastle United calling down a pit for a new centre forward, or in Nottinghamshire shouting down a mine shaft for a new fast bowler, neither soccer nor cricket were as intimately entwined with mining as rugby league was. Indeed, the underlying reasons for rugby's great split in 1895 can in part be blamed on the prominence of miners in rugby. Although rugby had been brought to the north of England by public school educated young men of the upper classes, within a generation it was enthusiastically taken up by miners. In 1883, a team from the pit village of Thorns near Wakefield won the Yorkshire Cup, the biggest upset so far in rugby's short life. Thorns also brought a new tactical sophistication to the game and showed that rugby was a sport for people of all classes. The presence of miners was not necessarily welcomed by those who ran rugby. In 1886, the Yorkshire Post published a letter from a former public schoolboy who complained about a recent match involving Horbury, a pit village near Wakefield, in which, he said, "A great many of the team were artisans and colliers. Now, I don't object to any working man, collier or whatever he may be, as long as he understands the game he is playing. But when in ignorance he puts on his working boots, which combined with betting on the event and brute force ignorance of the game of rugby union, is a disgrace to the prestige of dear old England for time-honoured fair play." Perhaps the best example of this early link between mining and rugby league can be found at the Railway Hotel pub in Featherstone, where a plaque not only says that the pub was the birthplace of Featherstone Rovers, but also that it was the site of the inquiry conducted into the shooting dead of two striking Featherstone miners during the Great Mining Strike of 1893. So when the Northern Union kicked off in 1895, it was common for teams from Wigan, St Helens, Castleford, Wakefield and even Hunslet to have teams composed almost entirely of miners. Harry Speed, the England international of the 1890s and captain of the original Castleford Northern Union team, was a surface worker at Glasshoughton Colliery and organised fundraising matches for striking miners. And in 1924, when Castleford reapplied to join Professional Rugby League, the first line of its application stated, "Our claim for inclusion as a first-class league club is based upon the fact that Castleford is the centre of a mining district." 2 years later, Featherstone Miners Welfare Club bought the post office road ground on behalf of the rugby league team. In 1934, over 1,000 miners at Featherstone's two pits voted for a weekly wage reduction of threepence to be donated to the club. We can even trace Wigan's nickname of the Pie Eaters back to the 1926 miners' lockout, when miners in Wigan were accused by their more militant rivals in St Helens of going back to work early and therefore eating humble pie from the mine owners. After World War II, rugby league had a new sense of national importance, which also dovetailed with the rhetoric of post-war optimism in the coal industry, which had been nationalised in 1947 under the National Coal Board. The National Coal Board's magazine Coal carried regular articles on the rugby league careers of miners and the importance of the game in mining districts. After the giant-killing victory of Cumbrian amateur pit side Risehow and Gilhead over Keighley in the Challenge Cup in 1948, the Coal Board's regional manager said, "Undoubtedly the club has helped improve production. I am certain that the social organisation, of which the club is a part, will continue to promote full cooperation between management and men." The 1946 Great Britain Tourists fielded a complete front row of miners, and five of the 1950 British Lions were also miners, three of whom came from Wigan. The two new post-war professional sites in Cumberland, Workington and Whitehaven, drew much of their playing strength and support from local pit communities. Whitehaven's ground, the Rectory, was originally the miners' welfare ground. In 1949, miners in Whitehaven began their shift early, at 2 o'clock in the morning, so that the later shift could finish work in time to go to the Whitehaven versus Warrington match later that day. The link between mining and rugby league continued strongly into the 1960s and 1970s, especially in the coalfields of West Yorkshire, with the mining towns of Castleford, Featherstone and Wakefield all winning the Challenge Cup and the latter two also winning the Championship between 1963 and 1977. This relationship was probably more profound than that which other sports had with coal mining. Although soccer in Scotland and the northeast of England were closely connected to mining communities, soccer did not have the intense physicality nor the shared sense of social exclusion that rugby league shared with mining. The only similar relationship between mining and sport was in South Wales, but Welsh Rugby Union, while it shared with league both its overt masculinity and collectivity on the pitch, was not an expression of any kind of working class identity. Indeed, some Welsh international union players who worked in mining were most definitely on the other side of the industry's class divide. Idris Jones, who captained Wales against Ireland in 1925, was the National Coal Board's first Director of Research, and Billy Cleaver, who played 14 times for Wales following the Second World War, was a colliery manager when he played for Wales and the British Lions in 1950. This difference was highlighted that year when a rugby union match was played between miners representing England and Wales. Previewing the game in the Coal Board's Coal magazine, Idris Jones claimed that rugby football has not gripped the imagination of coal miners in England and Scotland to anywhere near the same extent it has in Wales. A furious miner from Tilsley near Lee replied in the next issue that apparently miners in the north of England do not count in the eyes of the purists since their adherence is to the rugby league game. He went on to point out that in our mining district of Lee there is one professional club and approximately 30 junior clubs who are more genuinely amateur than many rugby union teams. Local colliers such as Astley and Tilsley, Bedford and Bickershaw compete with other mill and workshop teams in the Lee Amateur Rugby League. He ended with the challenge that if the old school tie brigade is unwilling to recognise the fraternisation of rival amateur codes, why not hold a second rugby international under league auspices? Needless to say, this was not taken up. The fact that it was a senior management figure in the coal board who was promoting rugby union and a miner from a traditional mining town who was defending rugby league seemed to highlight the difference between the two sports. But from the 1980s, the link between mining and league tended to be emphasised in the past tense, as the Thatcher government essentially closed down the industry. In 1996, just after the introduction of Super League, the novelist David Story, himself from a Wakefield mining family, linked the collapse of the coal industry to the decline of what he called league's traditional northern values. I used to think of rugby league as an extension of the coal mining industry, but now, of course, the coal mining has gone, and so has the confederacy that infused the game in the 50s and 60s, the camaraderie that came from a united struggle, whether it be against nature or the class system. Former Wakefield player and Castleford coach Dave Sampson went even further and argued that Great Britain's eclipse by Australia was due to the decline of mining. Years ago, men worked down the pit to come up to play rugby. My contention is that the toughness of the mind and body was made by the repetitive hard work and tough occupations that the people of the past had to endure. It's no surprise that we haven't won the Ashes since the 1970s, before the mines and the factories started to close. Like all generalisations, these beliefs contained a mixture of both truth and nostalgic myth. In fact, the identity between coal mining and rugby league remained strong into the 1990s, even as the last pits in the north of England were being closed. The reasons were not simply due to history and geography, but also to a shared conception of what being a miner and being a rugby league player represented. Both were seen as the most masculine expressions of work and sport, as the embodiment of collective teamwork, and, as Story hinted, as reflecting a degree of class consciousness. Today, there are no coal mines anymore in rugby league towns. In fact, very few of the industries which shape the sport, textiles, docks, engineering, glass manufacturing, exist anymore there at all. Yet the values and attitudes which emerged in those industrial working class communities, of fairness, opposition to injustice, and an anti-establishment spirit, remain as strong today in rugby league as they did 100 years ago. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. As you probably know, my Twitter handle is @ColinsTony and my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find a complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby and the other football codes, along with links for this episode. Until next week, Thanks for listening.